This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 003. In this show today, we're going to cover a huge chunk of fintech, and the most disruptive type of fintech at that, digital currencies. Why the most disruptive? Well, as long as money is government and bank-generated stuff, which of course is mainly bits in computers these days anyway, that sits in bank accounts, all fintech is in a sense playing around at the margin. There's also a political angle. Governments back to the decline of the Roman Empire and well before have always devalued currencies, making them a bad way to store your wealth in the long run. Furthermore, as we saw in 2008, in what has been called crony capitalism, taxpayers were forced by governments to bail out the banks. They could just as well, as happened in Iceland, bankrupted the banks and bailed out the mortgage holders. But I don't recall that ever being discussed or offered to the taxpayers as an option. So that's one extreme of the potential of digital currencies, liberating us from the power of governments and banks. At the opposite extreme, in fintech circles, one does hear the phrase Bitcoin loonies, which says a lot in itself. So where do we go? Where are we now on this spectrum of power to the people or power to the loonies? I'm very fortunate on the show today to welcome Dr. James Smith, CEO of Elliptic, a custodian for digital currencies, and we'll see why that's important later in the show. Elliptic recently raised $2 million, which puts them in the aristocracy class of London fintechs. James is definitely not a loony and has plenty of degrees in computer science, which is very helpful, as at the heart, Bitcoin is none of the above, but is a computer program. A computer program worth, in essence, around $10 billion right now. A computer program that is currently using more computing power every day than that of all the supercomputers in the world put together. It's also a very clever one with some complex fintech technology, which may well have other applications, and has proved pretty robust for 5 years, which is an amazing achievement in itself. So let's get on with the show. Hi, James. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me.
So, James, before we get into the sort of meat and all the complicated stuff about Bitcoin, going back to getting lots of degrees in computer science, how did you get from there to Google Campus and £2 million equity raising that you are today?
So I started doing Cambridge Computer Science undergrad, followed that up with a master's in speech and language technology, and then moved into a PhD at Oxford in machine translation, so using statistical methods to translate between English and French or English and Chinese, that sort of stuff.
And so presumably the English and Chinese was quite hard and the French was a bit easier?
I don't really speak much French either, so they're both pretty hard to me. But it was all data-driven, so you take a huge amount of text that's written down in both languages and use some statistical and some grammatical features of the languages to figure out what's the most likely translation of a new input.
Oh, that's interesting, because just in the 1970s I bought a book on language translation for computers, which of course couldn't be done in those days. And as you all know from knowing the history, their idea in those days was to understand what a sentence meant. So you go from a sentence in English to somehow representing the meaning of the sentence and then somehow expressing that in French, which wasn't really very successful.
Yeah, I mean, that was an approach, and there were also a lot of rule-based approaches where they tried to say this syntax in English translates to this syntax in French and try and swap the words around and make it work.
So how does Google do it these days? Because my kids, who are just doing GCSEs in languages, they spend most of their time doing their homework on Google Translate. Probably for better or worse. We'll see when the results come out on Monday.
Well, the big change really starts at the beginning of the 90s when a guy called Brown at IBM published a paper which started to use these statistical methods where it said this word most likely translates to this one, and this word is most likely followed by this one. And it used Bayesian statistics it's called a noisy channel model, to try and decode English into the foreign language.
Okay, so in essence, when I was a lad and I did computer science, the idea was that clever computer scientists would work out some clever code to do the answer. But as we found with the IBM Deep Blue winning the world chess championship, or at least beating... what's his name? Brute force. Brute force won out over clever computer scientists.
Well,
you still need a few of them.
It's clever computer scientists who have told the computer how to use all of that data. I think one of the quotes that's sometimes attributed to the IBM guys was, every time I fire a linguist, my language model gets better.
Fantastic. I heard the same thing about, a similar thing about, how do you value fintechs? It's sort of $1 million for each computer scientist, and you subtract $1 million for each MBA, which is a bit sarcastic. So then you were kind of finishing your PhD, and you decided to get a job in the city just after the city had blown up in 2008 or something like that.
So I was doing, in 2007, I was halfway through my PhD when subprime started rearing its heads, and that got me interested. And by the following summer, we'd had Bear Stearns, and then it was the week after Lehman crashed in sort of autumn of 2008 that I decided to start applying for jobs in trading.
Excellent. Perfect timing.
Absolutely, yeah. So, funnily enough, not many of the banks were hiring at that point, but I managed to find a job doing derivatives trading for a market making firm, because those kind of firms thrive off volatility, and there was plenty of that at the time.
So you gloss over, no doubt, the hard bit. When you say you managed to find a job, I mean, was that just, again, going back to brute force, was that just sending off 1,000 CVs and making 1,000 phone calls, or?
To some extent, although it was largely just neglecting my PhD for a few months whilst I focused on trying to figure out what trading meant.
Talking about brute force, then there's a lot of brute force involved, as I say, in Bitcoin today. Before we get on to Bitcoin, kind of digital currencies have really been around since the inception of the internet. I mean, I first saw the internet in pre-web days in the early 90s, and the person who was showing me at the time said, oh, when we get micropayments on the internet, then it'll really take off. Well, actually, that turned out not to be the case. It's when we had advertising on the internet, it really took off. But people have really been trying for quite some time before we had Bitcoin, which was also kicking off in 2008.
Yeah, so, I mean, Bitcoin didn't just appear out of nothing. Bitcoin was a big step. Loads of people have been researching it for a long time, and people have tried all sorts of things, and even some of the big names, Amazon and Facebook and lots of other companies in the past, had tried to create their own currency, but they've always been centralized. There's always been someone in charge of the currency, and that was what was big and different about Bitcoin.
Yeah, so this anonymous Satoshi Nakamoto, who wrote a paper and kicked the whole thing off in 2008, launching it in 2009, just starting from a computer science perspective, he came up with some pretty unique ideas and collection of previous ideas to improve upon the problems. And I think that at the biggest level, you know, so sometimes people say, oh, Bitcoin won't succeed. Maybe, maybe not. But everything in life is a stepping stone to tomorrow. In 10 years' time, we won't have it as we are now. Mm. But it's a huge leap forward, as you say, from where it was before. So what is his great leap forward that he made in roughly 2008?
So he or they, and we don't know whether it was one or many people.
And this week's theory, of course, being it's the NSA/CIA.
Yeah, I'm not sure. We'll see. Or maybe we won't. Yeah, the key innovation in Bitcoin was a solution to a problem of how you achieve consensus in a decentralized network. So how do you get everybody to agree on something when no one's in charge, no one's the arbitrator, no one's saying, okay, let's count the votes.
So just pressing pause on that bit, just going back to one step, just for those people who don't know, all banking systems in the world rely on, in essence, the bank keeping a ledger, the bank keeping a list of all transactions. Mm. So if my money is with Intelligent Finance and I spend some money, metaphorically speaking, Intelligent Finance have got a book and they just write a list in. Mike gives James £10 check. Mm. Mike takes £100 out of the ATM. So there's this central ledger. Now, as you say, and it's worth emphasizing, Bitcoin and Nakamoto's innovation was to do away with that centralized ledger. And this is very internet-like in that the internet is kind of peer-to-peer, or at least was in its original inception. I think it's slightly sort of varied since. But I think it's hard to explain how kind of innovative this is. We're all used to using Facebook or LinkedIn or something like that, which is a website owned by one company in one place, even if it's not quite like that. But that's basically the essence. Whereas the ledger in Bitcoin, the list of all transactions that have taken place, isn't in one place. And that's a very complicated thing to make happen.
Yeah, and that is really the key component of Bitcoin. It's not the economics of its current use as a currency or anything. It's the blockchain.
And the blockchain is the words given to this distributed ledger.
The blockchain is exactly that. It's an asset register. That's all it is. I mean, there are asset registers all over the place, except that in most places, they're controlled by somebody. So there's the land registry or the bank who keeps track of how much money each person has and so on. Whereas the blockchain technology, which is the backbone of Bitcoin, it's a list of transactions that anyone who wants to can be a holder of. So there are copies of it with everybody who's on the network. So if someone wants to change it, they need to convince more than half of the people on the network that it's different.
Okay, so and just on that, as I understand it, you can Google Bitcoin QT and you can download the software and run it on your computer.
Absolutely, yeah. Anyone can start up the software and can contribute to the running of the network.
This is another aspect in terms of transparency. I think it's still early days for kind of, quotes, growing up digital currencies away from governments. But they've got a number of unique aspects which I don't think we understand the full repercussions of, which is complete transparency. If you give me your, for example, the equivalent of an email address, then I can actually see what you've been up to.
Yeah, to some extent that's true, and there's pros and cons to that, certainly. And there are lots of different implementations of digital currencies. So Bitcoin is the one that's most prominent, but there are lots of clones that have all sorts of different features, and some of them are more anonymous than others.
So when people talk about Bitcoin, we can mean the program, we can mean the set of protocols that Nakamoto came up as the leading edge way of doing computers, or actually we can mean, you know, other digital currencies, most of which are operating on very, very similar principles of Bitcoin, because it's the leading edge understanding of how you do this distributed stuff. Mm-hmm. How for the first time in history, as it were, you do away with the king, you do away with the bank, you do away with the central authority, and somehow you make it, quotes, completely democratic, roughly speaking. And another point about just the technology, sticking with the sort of fintech tech or the computer science of it, you mentioned the land registry, and that's a good example. So another application of this technology could be, for example, that all properties in the UK are not stored at the land registry or are stored on a blockchain. And you might say, why? Well, one of the benefits of that could be that when you're doing the awful problem in the UK of buying and selling property and you're stuck in a chain, and it's interesting, it's also called a chain. Mm. Well, if you've got the whole chain, you could see where it wraps around the entire country. You could perhaps get the whole 100 people in your chain to settle, and you're not sitting around for months with your new baby on the way and wondering why someone won't buy yours because they can't sell theirs to somebody who can't sell theirs.
Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of potential implications for transparency in different areas. So it doesn't have to be completely transparent. It could be, depending on the application that you're trying to use this blockchain technology for, you might want complete transparency whereby everyone can see who's moved money to whom and so on. Or you might just want to take advantage of the fact that it's decentralized but still private and you can't see who's moving money where.
And again, that's a very important point. Thanks for making it, which is that when people talk about Bitcoin, Nakamoto wrote this paper in 2008, which is very worth reading because it's nice and simple and fairly clear. I thought it's only about half a dozen pages. That's kind of the core thinking. But then he made various implementation decisions, such as there will only ever be, whatever it is, 51 million coins or 21 million coins in existence. Well, that was just a particular implementation decision. Yep. It's a bit like describing that the internal combustion engine and the idea you've got a sort of steering wheel and gears and four wheels. You can make all sorts of motor cars out of that.
Yeah, so I mean, he developed this blockchain technology, and that was the amazing part. And then he decided to use it as a currency, and then his choices around the economics of the currency were probably driven largely by his political beliefs and so on.
So let's go on to creating your own currency, because again, I think the thing that people don't realize, and I didn't before I looked at this more closely, is that any listener today can actually create their own new digital currency. It's not very hard. There's sort of stuff out there and you can tinker with it and you can launch it. Hmm. And what distinguishes one from another is simply the take-up. So the analogy I always think of is it's a bit like Facebook. You can go out there and create your own Facebook today. And if you sign up more people than Facebook and everyone leaves that Facebook for your Facebook, then your Facebook suddenly becomes something incredibly valuable and you're worth a fortune on the stock market. And it's a similar kind of network thing here with this, which is kind of what succeeds and suddenly has massive value purely because it succeeded. It's a kind of Indian rope trick in a way.
Yeah, and it's the same with anything that relies on network effects. So it could be stock exchanges. You could go and set up your own stock exchange, but unless you can get everyone to come and trade on yours, it's no good. It's only the person who has the liquidity.
Absolutely. And I think the one thing I'd like to say to the listeners, to encourage them to go and set up their own currency, is there is one distinction from these analogies we've been using, I think, which is when you create your own currency, and you can explain this, I'm sure, much better than me, James, but there's this very important thing called data mining, which is, in a sense, poorly named. But basically, on Bitcoin, why people bother checking this distributed ledger is that every, whatever it is, 10 minutes, there's a little lottery, and the winner gets 25 Bitcoins, which is worth whatever, getting on for $15,000 at the moment. So when you're the first person to invent your currency, you're the only computer running it, and you're getting all of your, let's call it mic currency. I get all my mic currency for quite a while, and then I give some of them away to encourage it, and then other people get in. So Nakamoto, whoever he is sitting on millions of Bitcoins.
So let's talk about mining briefly. There's two ways that miners make money, and there's two functions to mining, really. And so it's confusing that they're both put together. The key reason to have miners is to support the network. What does that mean? Well, that's recording transactions. So if I send money to you, you send it to someone else. The miners are the ones who write it down in that asset ledger, which is distributed all around the world. So that's their key function. And at the moment, they're rewarded in Bitcoin specifically, not necessarily in all of the different clones, but in Bitcoin, the way it's been set up, they get rewarded through a transaction fee and also through, as you say, at the moment, it's 25 new Bitcoins for every 10 minutes or so. But that 25 Bitcoins is just because of the way Nakamoto decided to set the economics of this coin.
The point being there is that this distributed ledger only works if there's an incentive to do it. And one of the ironies we've got to, which is that because there is an incentive to do it, and again, my understanding is that at the moment there's something like 100,000 computers running this distributed ledger. So even if 99% of them crash, there'd still be enough to keep the Bitcoin network going. It's very robust. Unlike, I think it was a couple of years ago, when something like NatWest computers broke and then it just didn't work for a day and people couldn't transfer money. And I was at HSBC at the time sitting next to a guy who was trying to buy a house and his house thing didn't go through because the computers were down. Mm. It's very hard to take down a decentralized network that's all over the place. So why would people bother running this program? Well, the answer is there's the reward there, as you say, from the two types. And one of the perversities is that that's led to this complete arms race in terms of getting bigger and bigger computer to make more and more money and you're running more and more electricity through it.
Yeah, and also a lot of the mining is becoming more centralized in that there are big mining pools, so people work together to try and have a better chance of winning that award.
Because every 10 minutes, only one, as it were, computer or pool wins the lottery.
Yeah.
And that's the fastest one to do it. And there's a little twist here, which people don't necessarily need to get into, but basically updating the ledger isn't a very hard task. You know, computers are quite quick. I think I read that there's something like 7 Bitcoin transactions a second, so that's not many for a computer in 10 minutes. But in order to slow it down, which helps with a double spending problem, maybe you want to say something about that, there's a proof of work. So just briefly, what's the double spending problem and what's the proof of work?
So we talked briefly earlier about it being a decentralized consensus network. And what that means is there's a way that people agree on what has happened without anyone in the middle saying, yes, this is the authoritative answer. So every block in the blockchain, there's one generated about every 10 minutes, takes into account everything that's happened before it.
So that's the ledger. It's so like I'm making a new entry in the ledger. I have to really be congruent with everything that's ever been written in the ledger ever before.
Yeah, so when you're trying to add the next block, what you're trying to do is write down all of the transactions that have occurred since the last block, build them up into a block, and then insert it into the blockchain, on the end of the blockchain. And to do that, you have to, there's this thing called proof of work, which makes it hard to do that. As you say, it's easy to write down the transactions, but it's purposely made hard so that if you do solve this hard problem and manage to put it in there, then for someone else to come and fake it later on, they will have to do all of that hard work again. And the more blocks that have been added on since your block that you created, they would have to replicate all of that hard work for all of those blocks. And it becomes exponentially harder for somebody to fake a transaction or, as you say, double spend.
So metaphorically, just tricking on the blockchain thing, because I suspect that's the thing that's going to be around for years to come and we'll hear more of. If we metaphorically say that each block is just a page in a ledger, then as each 10 minutes goes by, then there's a competition to write down on the next clean page of the ledger all the transactions that have taken place. Mm-hmm. And at the bottom of the page, there's a problem which is really tough to solve. And it's going to take quite a while. This is why you need a big computer. Mm. The first person, it's a bit like bingo, the first person to stick out their arm saying, I've done it.
Yeah.
They will get the reward if other people in the network, in essence, check that they've done it properly.
Yeah.
And it's a bit like the bingo. So I go with my bingo card and, oh yes, you've got, I've never played bingo, but I mean, you've got three lemons or whatever, mixing my metaphors.
You should play bingo.
Yeah, exactly. Well, maybe I should play Bitcoin, which is the biggest bingo game going.
Yeah, so that's it. As you say, it's a competition. The first person to get it right shows everyone else they've got it right, and everyone says, oh, yeah, fair enough. And then everyone starts working on the next problem, because it's in everyone's interest to try to get working on the next one as soon as possible.
Okay, so then I think the last kind of computery science-y thing we want to touch on before we get up to the sort of more commercial applications of a digital currency, and Bitcoin is leading one at the moment, is this thing called open source. I think people know about open source, and open source means you can read all the code of the computer program, which means that in principle, you can sit there and you can check and see where the NSA is emailing itself a copy of information and all that kind of stuff. And so in principle, it is much easier to spot any issues with it, but also in practice it's being updated. So tell me a little bit about open source software, James. I mean, it's a bit like an aeroplane that's flying, and it's kind of upgrading itself as it's flying, isn't it?
Well, I think any software is like that, in that you would hope that something that is behind closed doors in some big software company is still being updated as it goes, otherwise it's going to get out of date. But what's great about open source software is that you're not just relying on how many programmers can you afford to keep checking over your code. You're opening up to everybody who's interested, and everyone can contribute their resources. So instead of having 100 or 1,000 pairs of eyes on it, which is what you might be able to afford if you're a big company developing the software, suddenly you have every interested party can check through the code. And so there are so many more pairs of eyes, and people with different ambitions and different ideas about how things can be done, all looking to make sure that there's no back door and so on.
And one of the most interesting things that for me is that over the last 20 years, that has been amazingly successful.
Mm.
Loads of servers around the world, I don't know what the fraction is these days, are running open source software.
Absolutely. I mean, Microsoft used to have lots of control over the software people should use on their servers, and then Linux came along, and it was great, it was free, it was open source, people could change it to the way they wanted it to be.
Yeah. Okay, so that's all wonderful. As we're talking about a little bit before, kind of speaking as computer people, you can be given a huge printout of code, and it depends how many thousands and thousands and thousands of lines long it is. So how big is the Bitcoin program, for example? How long would it take you to read it? How long would it take you to understand it? How long would it take you to go through it?
So there are actually a few implementations of it now. I mean, that's the other great thing about it. People can, the original version by Nakamoto was written in C++, but people have done it in a few different languages. So in terms of pages or lines of code, it will really depend on which implementation you look at. It's not small, but it's, and there are some very subtle points to it. But it's not impossible to read through, it's not ridiculous, and there are a lot of people who do fully understand all of the details of the code.
So basically, somebody suggests an improvement, and then the network votes on it,
mm-hmm.
in a kind of democratic fashion, and then somehow it's kind of mixed with some Darwinianism, which is whatever succeeds, succeeds.
Yeah.
And everybody's self-interested is in keeping the network working.
Yeah, I mean, that's a key point, in that the people who run the network have invested a lot of time and cost into technology in making this thing work. So it's not in their interest to disrupt the network or bring it down. The changes, they try to make them as infrequently as possible, but when one needs to be made, there'll be advance warning to all of the miners, the people who are running the network, make sure that people are happy with the changes, and then try and move it fairly swiftly onto the new version so that everybody's singing off the same hymn sheet.
Okay, so I think we've sort of done a little bit of a minor deep dive, at least for the layman, into some of the computer science behind it. And I think one of the reasons for doing that was just to expose some of the thinking that lies underneath this current currency called Bitcoin and many of the other current digital currencies, not least of which I think that it's kind of meaningless to say, oh, Bitcoin won't succeed. The technology it's using will continue. It will be amended and it will be used, even if Bitcoin, the currency, disappears.
Yeah, I mean, whether it's used as a currency or as, you know, as we said, a land registry or as a register for equities or bonds or whatever else, the technology is great.
And the purpose of the technology is that for the first time, you don't need a central authority. You don't need a king. You don't need a bank. You don't need a stock exchange. As long as you set up a network correctly, the network can take over those things in the same way the internet has. There isn't a computer called the internet.
No.
All connecting to. Okay, so zooming up then more to the commercial application of digital currencies and this kind of thing. And obviously there's a number of aspects to that. And I think one reason that Bitcoin suddenly hit the presses as much as it has is that although it's been around for a few years, it was only last year when roughly speaking, it went from $10 at the beginning of the year to peaking at almost $1,000, a hundredfold increase, which attracted a lot of people's attention, that Bitcoin became very big. And then, of course, when it's suddenly worth 10 billion rather than 10 million, it gets a lot more attention from hackers and all this kind of stuff. And therefore, if you're, for example, an institution or a fund and your client or clients want some exposure to the digital currencies, it doesn't have to be Bitcoin, there are other ones around, in case it goes up another thousandfold, you then need to start thinking of what you might call boring, but very important, kind of robust financial services, custodial services, and all this kind of stuff to make sure you don't lose it. Because one thing we haven't mentioned is that your proof you've got a Bitcoin isn't essentially a password. Let's just say, you know, Canada. I mean, in practice, it's 34 digits, but let's say my password is Canada. I keep this word Canada to myself because the word Canada is my proof that I own the Bitcoins. The only proof of ownership is this password, this 34-digit thing. So you can easily lose it, or someone can easily steal it, or stuff like that. And this is where Elliptic comes in, of course, your company.
One of the great things about Bitcoin is it gives control of the asset back to the person who owns the asset. They don't have to rely on somebody else necessarily. But then the danger of that is that it gives control to the person. And if they are not technically aware, or they've got, you know, for lots and lots of different reasons, they could lose that key if they don't have the appropriate backups or they don't store it in the right places.
Famous case is the guy in New York who threw away his hard drive and it was worth
Guy in Wales.
Yeah. Right, okay. It threw away his hard drive, it was worth several million. Without the password, which is harder to remember than the word Canada, you can't get your Bitcoins, unlucky. Mm. So this, plus the risk of theft, is where Elliptic come in, and you're, as I understand, trying to be digital custodians for these kind of Bitcoins. So if you're a kind of institution or if you're an individual, you can hold the Bitcoins yourself in this thing called a Bitcoin wallet on your phone or online if you're slightly crazy, in my humble opinion. Or you can just employ Elliptic for a very small fee, and they far cleverer than we are, and they will just make sure it doesn't get stolen. So for example, a simple way of making sure it doesn't get stolen is you could write it down on a piece of paper and bury it somewhere in your garden in a box, and then nobody could digitally nick that because it's not connected to a network.
Yeah, we think that the infrastructure needs to improve. And, you know, this problem we're talking about keys getting stolen easily, might mean that Bitcoin in its current form is not great as a retail currency. You know, it's not great for us to hold all of our savings in and go and spend it on coffee. I don't know. Some people disagree with me on that. We do think that there is a lot of value to the technology, as we've already discussed, but also some potential big value to this Bitcoin in its current form, whether it's as a sort of commodity-like asset or whether it's as an international currency. I don't think we know the answer to definitively yet, but we do know that there needs to be infrastructure in place, and one of those things is secure custodianship. So we have the expertise to store securely, to understand the protocols and the controls around how people should move this asset. And on top of that, all of the funds that are stored with us are insured. So even if somehow somebody managed to steal the Bitcoins, our insurance covers that.
That's cool. So just to make this point, I mean, there are a lot of people who are really into Bitcoins and are really into the detail and all this kind of stuff, and they'll have their own views. Mm. But certainly, if you're an institution without that kind of deep commitment, or if you're an individual who just wants to have a few Bitcoins and participate in the whole process, then I'd really recommend that they check out you guys. I'm not saying that because I'm here and crawling. It's vice versa, actually. And there's quite a good synchronicity story about when we met. We were in a group of Eddie George's New Finance discussing digital currencies, and we're talking about the whole thing about trust how can you trust a digital currency? And I, in my usual way, was waffling away saying, I think this is a great company, actually, because they insure your Bitcoins, so you can't lose them, even if they blow up, they're insured. And you said, yes, it's my company. So that's quite a cool synchronicity, along with the fact that you and I both had the same supervisor at Cambridge, although yours many decades later. Came back to Bitcoin, it's a digital currency. I don't think digital currencies are going away. I'm quite sure they'll be here in 5 or 10 years' time. And hopefully you guys will be insuring them and making sure you don't lose them. Because if I was going to buy a Bitcoin, I'd certainly sweat quite a lot about sticking it on my phone or on my computer, especially with all the stuff about the NSA and everybody else peeping over my shoulder.
Yeah, and I think it's important to point out that Bitcoin solves some problems, but doesn't solve every problem. It's not just a complete replacement for the financial system. And we need a lot of the same things that exist in the financial system, like custodianship. It solves some technology problems, but humans are still the same, and who we trust still matters. And it's still important that we have the right relationships with people who control our assets and so on. So we're trying to bridge that gap between this new technology and this sort of wild west of digital currencies and the financial world, which we know from having worked in it.
So as I see it, you guys are, you know, one of the first steps to professionalizing the whole industry. And I think, you know, it's not a coincidence that, as I understand, you're the first guys to be given serious funding, by which I mean seven-figure funding, in London to do that.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's just the beginning, I hope, for us of a long journey of bringing this to the real world rather than just this niche little area on the internet.
Time flies by as it does, and that's quite a good time just to wrap up, James, by asking you to get your crystal ball out and give me your view about where you think digital currencies are going in the next sort of 5 years or so.
Yeah, so I think that in 5 years' time, it's still going to be considered early days for this technology. The internet's 10 years was still pretty immature. But I think what I'm excited about is the other uses of the blockchain technology other than just this internet currency. So I think it would be fascinating if a government starts using it to represent their national currency. For example, the Bank of England could issue pounds on a blockchain rather than on pieces of paper. It could be used, as we've said, for all sorts of different asset registers, whether it's for stocks and shares. And I think that all of these different applications, they're going to change the way professional services are done, just because it's a different way of registering your assets.
And I think for people who don't follow this space, they may not have seen the modern version of politicians kissing babies before an election. Insofar as, I think it was last week, I saw a photo of the Chancellor, George Osborne, at a Bitcoin ATM. And certainly the regulatory authorities are looking at it very seriously over here, and also from a very helpful perspective, given that the UK government and the Mayor's office do have a very kind of pro-fintech outlook at the moment. And as I saw from your website, you and Demos and people like that are in Downing Street and, you know, discussing it with the government and all the powers that be about what happens. So this is certainly here at the moment. And in the UK, people are trying to work out how to do it well. And that's the interesting thing for me about fintech, is that we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow.
No. I mean, as you say, I think London's just going to be a great place for digital currencies. It's right between, you know, up here around Silicon Roundabout, we've got the great tech, and 2-minute walk down the road is the city. London's the centre of the world for finance. And digital currencies sit right in the middle of those two things. And I think London's going to be a great place for it.
Well, what a fantastic note to end on. Anyone would think you'd read that from a piece of paper, but you haven't. Okay, thanks very much, James.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app. Or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts of new episodes. Live long and prosper.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city with a tarmac so dead. And and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so gray, with the pain of the the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. City goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight dance.